Got Zuckerman in the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, the Concerto Grosso No. 1 in G by George Frideric Handel. He wrote when he was 55 from Opus 6.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn at Henry Ford Community College, and happy holidays to you and yours from our family here at WHFR. To learn more about the exciting Dearborn Symphony Orchestra season, we have an opportunity for you to call this number, 313-565-2424. That's 565-2424. Next edition of the Symphony Orchestra season is called From Russia with Love, and it'll take place Friday, February the 6th, 2009. I'm sure you will enjoy it, as everyone is just a class act. We have classical programming your way throughout the overnights here at WHFR, and we hope you're enjoying the programming. Some special holiday programming as we enter into 2009 and beyond as well. Suggestions, ideas, always love to hear from you. 313-845-9842. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
The story is about a bizarre woman. She has a beautiful soul, but she's kind of strange. She's moody, she's domineering, but somehow she's still likable. What she doesn't have are children. In a patriarchal society, this is a big problem. No children means no identity, no substance, no meaning. And in this opera, she has no shadow. Die Frau ohne Schatten, The Woman Without a Shadow, an unusual Strauss opera full of symbolism and myth. We'll hear selections from it coming up this hour of classical music with the Minnesota Orchestra and AGOA. I love this piece. The story goes that John Adams got a ride from a friend of his who had a really fast sports car, and it wasn't a very long ride. I think the guy wanted to save his tires or something, and John Adams came up with a piece to describe what that felt like.
WHFR Dearborn.
Morning. You are listening to Then and Now, presented on WHFR Dearborn from 10 to 11 a.m. and the fourth Saturday of every...
Well, thank you, Melissa, and I am, of course, Ned, and today we have an unusual topic. It's not what I usually do, as you, those of you who are regular listeners, we're going to do somewhat of a book review. And it is connected with our usual topics of how history affects current events. So we're going to go into a little bit of history. Our guest today is Mr. Tom Maradian. And Mr. Maradian has written a book entitled The Repatriate, Love, Basketball, and the KGB, An Untold Story from Behind the Iron Curtain. And this book is published by Tom under a title called Maradian Publishing, and the it can be found by www.tommaradian.com. It's distributed, more importantly, by Wayne State University Press right here in Michigan at Detroit, Michigan, 48201. And the price of the book is $24.95. And Tom's story is so interesting because he was born and raised right here among us here in metropolitan Detroit. And our program is going to take the shape of, Tom, I should welcome you first.
Thank you.
I'm glad that we're able to do this.
And I'm glad I'm here.
What we're going to do is divide the program into four segments. First, we're going to talk about Tom personally, his background, what happened to him, why he decided to make his journey to the Soviet Union. And then we're going to talk about, after that, something about why this was all done. Third section, we're going to talk a little bit about his great deal about his experiences in the Soviet Union. And the fourth section will be how his experiences and what he's learned there, how that might give some explanations as to what's happening in the former Soviet Union, now Russia, and the meaning of some of the things that are happening today. Hopefully we'll interweave that throughout. So, Tom, here you are, a young boy of 19 years old. Tell us something about yourself, where you were born, you were raised personally.
I was born here in Detroit, raised in Detroit, educated in Detroit. I've been always an American, except for 13 years. For 13 years, I lived behind the Iron Curtain as a Soviet citizen during the Cold War. And for 13 years, I tried to get back and wasn't able to until 1960, during a period when Khrushchev came into power.
Okay, but tell us about you as a young man here in America first. We want to establish, you know, where you went to school.
I went to Southwestern.
You were a basketball player. Get into that.
I went to Southwestern High School, played ball, graduated among the top five in my class. I was a all-city, all-state player, and in 1946, the Detroit Free Press, the Detroit Times, and the Detroit News picked me all-city, and the Detroit Free Press picked me player of the year. I helped Southwestern win their first city championship. We played at Olympia before a record crowd of 15,000 people, and we played Miller High School, which was a all-black high school, and it was considered one of the best games ever played in the high school circuit. We won, and...
Did you go to a state championship after that?
No, ironically, the Michigan High School Athletic Association, several years before, did not permit Detroit to compete in state tournaments because Detroit was too violent. We were tough guys. And they didn't figure that we should be playing against teams like Flint Central or Bay City or any other team. So... winning the city championship meant we considered that we were state champs.
I see.
During that time, the Associated Press picked the number one team.
I see. So you were a basketball player even when you were very young, or when did you pick up on basketball?
I started to play. I think they said I was born with a basketball in my hand, and I followed some of the best. I carried the satchels of some of the best ball players in this state, Frank Sable, Billy Chanko. I watched Tino Sabuco. Of course, at our school, there was Barney McCoskey.
Don't mean much to us today.
I'll bet you they do. You sell their cards, their baseball cards, and these people... if you have a Barney McCoskey card, I'm sure you can sell it in the thousands of dollars.
Was he a professional basketball player later?
He was a professional baseball player for Southwestern. Stanley LaPata was also a professional baseball player. And Stanley was 2 or 3 years ahead of me. He played ball with my brother but in fact, both of my brothers.
So you became known as a very good and prominent basketball player in the Detroit community during your time.
Did you
play basketball in the Armenian Youth Federation leagues?
No.
No, you didn't do
no,
that.
No, okay. I did not speak Armenian. I had little association with the Armenian community.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, many considered me a odad.
I see.
And odad is a non-Armenian.
I see. Isn't that strange? When you ended up in the Soviet Union, you got stuck in Armenia. I bet you learned Armenian then.
Oh, you bet I did. You bet I did.
Okay. So now our listeners are going to wonder, why is it a young all-American boy who has lost his ethnic identity of his parents, how is it that you end up going to the Soviet Union? Can you tell us something about your father's background and his interest in these things that got you caught up in it?
Before we get to my father, my two brothers were also excellent athletes, and they were in the Navy. One was a gunner, one was a pilot, and I was hoping that I was young. I wasn't in World War II. I was hoping to follow in their footsteps, but America kicked the Nazis' butts, and the war ended in 1945, and there was no war. There was peace. Russia was our ally. Franklin Delano Roosevelt called Stalin, who was the dictator of the Soviet Union at that time,
Uncle Joe.
Uncle Joe, absolutely. In fact, Henry Wallace, the vice president, made several trips to the Soviet Union and applauded the achievements of the Soviet people.
Yeah. Henry Wallace was a well-known fellow traveler. Too.
Well, I don't know if he was well-known, but he was
He is now.
Well, yes. But obviously, he stepped down. He was asked, or if you want to say, FDR dumped him for a guy by the name of Harry S. Truman, and then Roosevelt died, and Truman became president. If he had not been dumped, we could have possibly had a communist president.
Anyway, based on our time limit for the first quarter, tell us something about how you got interested in leftist politics, which has to do with your father, because the next period we'll go on to.
My father, like many, 15 million Americans, during the Great Depression, lost his job. He lost everything he had. He ran a coffee house for Armenian immigrants during the early 20s, and during that dark day in 1929, and it's similar to what is happening today. The Wall Street crashed, and he lost everything, and he became a communist, a card-carrying communist. He also was a union organizer. He helped bring the union to Kelsey Hayes Wheels, and I would watch the union leaders gather in our house and talk about organizing unions at Ford Motor Company, at General Motors, the Flint sit-down strike, the battle of the on the bridge where Bennett beat
Overpass.
Overpass, okay. All of us came to our house, and
so you were brought up with that milieu.
Absolutely.
Which is okay. That gives us some background. So the war, your father had these tendencies, and obviously you and your brothers were imbued by them. I suppose
not my brothers. No, they did not They were not involved. They were in the war. My father did not drive a car. I was his chauffeur. Even though I was 14 years old, we were allowed to drive if we did not have anyone in the family without a license or didn't know how to drive. So I would drive him to the union leaders, meetings. And in fact, my uncle, Paul Kay, became the president of local UAW CIO 600.
600, still here.
Still here, yes.
They call it the Red Union now, still.
I don't know why they would call it a Red Union, because they are workers like everybody else.
It's the nomenclature that's given to 600. I don't know why.
Well, it is erroneously given, because I don't think a worker should be called a communist or even a fellow traveler just because he rolls up his sleeves and works on a production line.
Well, so now that establishes some background as to... But 1947, what was going on in 1947 that you felt your father didn't want to go back to go to the Soviet Union? He managed to talk you into doing it, or it was your own volition?
It was my own volition. I decided that I wanted to go. And there's a letter from my history teacher in that book. There's a letter from a prominent labor writer in the book about my father. I wanted to go to see what was on the other side of the mountain. I had heard enough from our newspapers. I had followed the war, every single battle in Russia, in Africa, in Italy, in Europe, and I was intrigued how Russia, a backward country, could defeat the Nazi army. I did go to Stalingrad. I was at Kursk. I was in Leningrad. I had the ability to see the destruction war can cause.
But we're not there yet. We just wanted to talk about why you wanted to go. And then, so you made this decision unilaterally. Your father wasn't behind it.
Oh, he was absolute. When I announced that I was going, he was very happy because he could not go, and he wanted someone in the family to go. And I would think.
Why couldn't he go?
Because he had two sons, a daughter, and a wife to support. He believed in fighting for the union, the labor movement, and. He thought if I would go, I would be able to...
So he still had work to do in America.
Absolutely.
Okay. We're at our first station break time. Well, 15 minutes has gone by the program. You are listening to WHFR on 89.3 FM, and we are here at the Henry Ford Community College making waves... For all of our listeners, and those are electronic waves, not water waves, and we hope you're enjoying our program today. Our program today is a book review and an interview with the author. The name of the book is The Repatriate, Love, Basketball, and the KGB, and our author is Tom Maradian, and this is the untold story from his experiences from behind the Iron Curtain. And as you heard in the beginning, he was a basketball player, and that's why basketball became so important here. This book is published by Maradian Publishing, distributed by Wayne State University Press. This book is also available online with Borders, Amazon, Barnes and Noble bookstores as well. And you and I am your host, Ned Apigian, on your monthly forum talk shows here at the station, where this show is entitled Then and Now as to How History Affects Current Events. And Tom's story will eventually get us into some history about his experiences in the Soviet Union. Now, at this part of the program, I'd like to have Tom concentrate on what does a person have to do in order to go to the Soviet Union? What's the first thing that happens? Give us the sequence of events, beginning and then ending up with you getting on the boat, and what were some of the requirements of the United States government and the Soviet government. So this part of the program will be devoted to how do you arrange this?
Ned, I was 19 years old. I was naive and did not know the process of denouncing the U.S. My U.S. citizenship. To this day, I don't know what were the ramifications of my act.
Or the requirements.
All I know is that I was allowed to join 151 others in November of 1951 to leave the United States and to go to the Soviet Union. This is the year 1947. I'm only 19. I looked forward to going. I was enthused because here now I can see these historic cities, these places and sites of historic battles. Immediately getting on the Russia, a ship seized by the Soviets for reparations, $1 billion reparations.
It was from whom?
From the German government, the Navy. German people, because believe it or not, the Russians asked for $1 billion and they got it. But they also took all of their ships that they can seize. And while they were dismantling Germany, we were trying to get all of the nuclear secrets, atomic secrets, and everything else the Germans had.
So my point is, so what do? You write a letter to the Soviet embassy? I'd like to leave? How's the process? People want to know, how do you do that?
Well, I can
tell
you.
Did your father take care of it?
You asked me how I did it. I do not know. But later I learned from the members on that ship.
Okay.
Well, here's the process that you would have to denounce your U.S. citizenship, be accepted by the Soviet government, and obviously leave the United States for the Soviet Union. Understand, during this time, there was a wide range of propaganda in all over the world to bring back Armenians to Soviet Armenia. There was a proposal.
As well as other countries, I'm sure. Georgians returned to Georgia. Ukrainians returned to the Ukraine.
The Yalta Agreement, signed by Churchill and FDR, stated that all military, Soviet military personnel and prisoners would be transferred back to the Soviet Union. They signed, the West signed these prisoners' execution warrants. Anyone returning to the Soviet Union who were prisoners.
Well, yeah, I know that story. But
you know the story.
Yeah, but
we didn't know that story. And it wasn't broadcast.
So how did you get to the ship in New York? Did you ask? Somebody had to give you permission. That's what I'm talking about.
I was accepted as one of the 151 to repatriate from Detroit. And my brother and mother accompanied me to New York City.
It was 151 from Detroit or 151 from the United States?
From the United States. When we reached New York, they allowed me on the ship. But ironically, my name was not on the passenger list. And we...
And they let you on.
And they let me on. I don't want to give away my story, Ned. I think people would be very interested in the events that led up to my repatriation, not repatriation, but my departure and the trip over. About a third of the first part of the book is devoted to that part.
Well, I mean, if I was a listener to the program, and here you are, an all-American boy, basketball player, you've been influenced by your father's union activities for justice for the workers of the world. How do you go from that to a ticket on a boat? Excuse me.
Okay. The Armenian Progressive League financed the trip over by the Armenian Americans. And obviously, I did not need anything except my clothes until I got there. I intended to go to school there for a year and turn around and come back. That did not happen.
Excuse me. Okay, that's a little bit of information. I'm familiar with the Armenian Progressive League. This is a leftist organization of which many... a lot of Armenians were involved with, and so somebody, obviously your father, must have gave your name to them, and you were included on a list, and they paid for the repatriates.
Yes, they did. Many of these people from all over the country, we had doctors, we had engineers, gave up everything. They sold everything and went back to help build Soviet Armenia. They were loyal Armenians.
Right.
And I call them very courageous.
They sure were, because they didn't know what they were getting into. But the important thing here is, so you are now, when did this denunciation take place that you had to do? Was it on the ship prior to you leaving, or you never denunciated anything? They just said you denunciated.
My understanding is that my father signed the papers because I was a minor to allow me to repatriate. That's what I think happened. I personally signing anything, I doubt that very much. My understanding of the trip was that if you did not like it, and in subsequent recent days, talking to others that have survived the ordeal, young men, they have told me they also thought that once they got there, if they did not like the society, the environment, the people, that they would be allowed to turn around and come back.
You don't have anything like that in writing?
No, that is a fantasy, that is hearsay, but it was a time that we believed in everything that was in black and white.
So your assumption is that your father signed a piece of paper indicating that his minor son can go. Your name was put on the list to be supported by the Armenian Progressive League, and your father and your brothers took you on a train ride to New York. Somebody must have told them when the ship was to arrive and leave. So they had that information. Strangely, your name wasn't on the list, but you got on
the passenger list.
Right.
The Progressive League headquarters did have my list. Ironically, I was approved, and I had my parents weren't going, my brothers weren't going, and they're saying, why is Tom going? Nobody knew. When I got on the ship, the Armenians on the ship thought I was an Odar. They thought I was a FBI agent.
Because you didn't speak Armenian.
I didn't speak. In fact, 3 or 4 days ago at St. John's, I'm sitting there, And the gentleman looks at me, and he talks to a friend of mine and says, "As odara inchkone ester." This foreign guy.
Non-Armenian.
None.
What's he doing here?
What's he here for? And I looked at him and said, "Hayren Hosuem. I do speak Armenian." He said, "Who are you?" I said, "I am Tom Maradian." I won't divulge the person's name because he is a prominent Armenian here in the community.
Well, the important thing is you're now on the boat ride. How was the boat ride there? Because our next break's going to come up in a minute or two. Was it comfortable? Or was it?
It was beautiful. It was idyllic. You could not have beat it.
Was it a passenger liner that they had taken?
A month before we got on that ship, 1,500 Armenian French boarded the Russia and went to Yerevan. That's obviously, I learned that after I got there.
Right. Then that same boat came to the States?
Came to the States, and only 151 of us on this huge ship. There were also a handful of Jewish Americans heading for Haifa. And I'm not going to spoil the story because they also were going on a mission.
So maybe that boat only stopped. Where did it stop?
Before it got to Marseille, I wanted to go home. I was homesick in the Atlantic.
I see.
I told myself...
Why did it stop in Marseille?
A trip over. It's a long trip. You got to get supplies. You got to keep...
Okay.
This is 1947.
Okay, so...
And we're heading for Marseille, and one of the repatriates who knew that I wanted to get off the ship, wanted to help me off the ship. But it didn't happen. And I would spoil it for my readers if I tell you what happened. From Marseille, we went to Naples. From Naples, we went to Port Said.
Mm-hmm.
From Port Said, which is in Egypt
now,
from Port Said, we went to Haifa.
Well, then the Jews got off at Haifa, I guess.
Yes, they did.
Okay. They were the lucky guys.
I don't know if they were lucky because
that's where they wanted to go. So.
Yes, to die probably. To die because there wasn't a Jewish state. The Jewish state became a reality in 1948.
I understand.
So these people went in to fight for their country.
Yeah, but that's where they wanted to go. That's where they were.
Absolutely.
God bless those people that end up where they want to go. You ended up where you wanted to go, too. Now we're at the midpoint of the program, which when we come back from our station identification, you'll tell us about your experiences in Armenia, because that's where you were going, to Armenia, right?
Yerevan.
Yeah. And then right now, you are listening, dear listeners, to Then and Now, a program devoted to how history affects current events. And on our present show, hopefully we'll get into that with this book review as well. You are listening to WHFR 89.3 FM, and we are here at the Henry Ford Community College of Dearborn, making waves, introducing you to our topic today. You are listening to your host, Ned Alpigyan, and our guest today is Tom Maradian, who is a repatriate to the United States because he left the United States in 1947 to go to the Soviet Union, and being a basketball player became his job when he ended there. And the book says, Love, Basketball, and the KGB. It's an untold story from behind the Iron Curtain. Tom eventually comes back. At the quarter program, we'll talk about him coming back. And right now, this book is distributed by the Wayne State University Press. And the book can be purchased online at Borders, Amazon, and Barnes & Noble bookstores as well. And we hope that you are intrigued by whatever Tom is able to tell you in this brief, somewhat less than an hour program to encourage you to go buy the book. And so you could hear Tom's full story. It is a strange story how a red-blooded American boy who's a basketball player goes to the Soviet Union. Basketball ends up being his life there. And then eventually how he comes back. So, Tom, now you're on the boat. Where did the boat stop? Somewhere in Georgia or where?
We went through the Dardanelles, and there we see Turkey.
Yeah.
And the Turkish captain comes up to navigate us into the Black Sea.
Okay.
Here's a Turkish captain on a ship with 150. One of us dies on that ship.
Okay.
He was elderly.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, we have tension. And one of the older Armenians tells me, "Don't you get involved." I says, "What's going to happen?" "Well, if you have 150 Armenians, most of them whose fathers, mothers, brothers died during the 1915 genocide, what do you think is going to happen?" I didn't say a darn word. I watched. The captain came aboard. He was escorted by the captain of the ship. Nothing happened. The Turkish captain took us through the Dardanelles into the Black Sea and got on his small ship. What happened on that ship? I will not tell you. You will have to read the book.
Well, the ship landed where?
Batumi.
Batumi.
Soviet.
Georgia.
Georgia, where American battleships. Battleships are today. Where Americans have now come to the protection of a democratic Georgia. And I wonder who the aggressor is, Georgia or Russia?
Okay. I could give you my opinion about that.
That's what we're here for, opinions.
It's not relevant
because you
to
would,
your story.
I don't think.
So how did you get from Batum to Yerevan? A train?
Was that before we board the train, we are ushered into barracks, warehouses, and the odyssey, the idyllic trip ends. Now we have sevhats, chai without sugar, cheese.
Yeah, sevhats is black bread.
Thank you. I was hoping that you would fill in. Yes.
It sounds black, good to me. Is that bad? Or what?
Oh, yes, with stones, sawdust. We could not eat it. Well, I couldn't anyway. Mm-hmm. And the Americans, who were wise enough to bring canned goods, started to open up their canned goods to give to their children, because there were kids, 4 years old, infants in our group. And it's so ironic that...
That's a detail. The important thing is it wasn't good. The experience was a shock. How long did it take to get you on a train?
About 2 weeks.
It took 2 weeks to get a train to get you to Armenia. What happened when you got your train ride? Was that decent?
Every stop was beautiful because hundreds of deratsis, those are the
people lining the road, welcoming you new.
Oh, absolutely. Because they heard the Americans are coming.
Right.
And we're bringing them millions of dollars of manufactured goods, cars, refrigerators, and ourselves.
And you brought, there were things like that on the boat, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, we didn't mention that at that phase. So when you come to Yerevan, what happens? You drive your car off and they take it away, the refrigerator?
No, they did not. And I'd like to make it clear that there was propaganda on both sides of the Atlantic. Recently, during my research, I found a article written in 1951 quoting me about some things that I never said. But I won't go into that.
What happened when you get to Yerevan? Where did they take you? They give you an apartment?
Yes, they gave me, all of us.
You being 19 years old, it's not like you had a wife or family. What did they do with you?
There were apartments built for us, shabbily built, and no electricity at first, no running water. There were cracks in the floor and ceilings.
Were all you people together in these buildings, or did they separate you?
We were fortunate. There were at least five or six Armenian-American families in one of the buildings, and I was in one of them. The others were in different spots throughout the city.
So did you get an apartment or a room or what?
I got a room as big as your office here.
Studio. Not with another family, by yourself?
There was two other bachelors in that.
Okay.
And I only had a suitcase and a trunk, but the other gentleman
had stuff.
Had a lot of stuff that had to be left outside and in the elements. And there were others that had crates, which were eventually brought to us, that had to stay outside.
So how long does it take for them to designate what they're going to do with you? They're going to make you a basketball player in the Soviet Union.
They don't designate anything.
How did that all happen?
Well, you go looking for a job. You go to a commissar. You look just like here.
You have to go look for a job.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And I had no talents except playing basketball. I wanted to go to school, so I went to the Foreign Language Institute and applied, and they said that your language school, you do not know Armenian, you do not know
Russian,
you can teach English, but you'd have to communicate, and you cannot communicate, so why don't you study?
Learn Armenian.
And come back.
Okay.
In the meantime, you have to live. Unfortunately,
Does socialist heaven, don't they feed you over there?
I don't know of any country that will feed anybody without work, without paying. If you know Marxism and Leninism, you know the good old slogan, whoever works, eats.
Okay.
I didn't work, I didn't eat.
Okay.
Ironically, the Americans that arrived there with their refrigerators and their
cars,
and you name it, they were able to sell off. Their items were not seized, as one article pointed out. They were able to slowly sell. But what happens when you sell and don't accumulate?
But you didn't have nothing to sell.
Yes, I didn't. I sold my clothes. They love my neckties because they can turn it into stockings, shirts. So that was how I lived for about 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
Selling my clothes.
What happens when you're down to your underwear?
You think, okay, how could we go home? Now, Armenians also like to marry Odars. There were three in our building. There was an Irish woman from the east. There was a Polish woman. These are married to Armenians. A Polish woman from Detroit. Another woman from Chicago. One day, when we were around the courtyard fire, we build bonfires to keep ourselves warm in the evening because it's winter. And
is this relevant to how you became known as a basketball player?
Oh, but it is involved in my arrest and the arrest of some of the other people. Because these Americans approached me and said, hey, we got to contact the U.S. Embassy and ask him, beg him to let us go home. And if he can't help us, to bring our plight before the United Nations.
How are you supposed to do that?
I was supposed to take a plane on May 1st to go to Moscow, when there would be a lot of foreigners in the city, and sneak into the U.S. Embassy and present the letter to the ambassador, before I even got on the plane.
Yeah, but our program is getting to be three quarters over, and Boy. We're not at basketball yet. So
okay.
How is it?
Anyway,
basketball saved your life in the Soviet Union.
One day, Abraham, who was a basketball player from Port Said, heard about me playing basketball and said, why don't you try out for our institute team? At first,
How did anybody know you played basketball? Was there a ball and a hoop around where you were?
No. The American repatriates who were selling their clothes in the black market, Abraham would go pick up things or sell some of his own stuff. And one of the repatriates who is now in Fresno, California, told Abraham that, you know, we have an American here that played basketball in the States. You may want to talk to him. Abraham did catch up to me. He did convince me that I should play, and I did.
So you didn't have a pair of shorts that you were selling that somebody said, what's this?
And I didn't have any jocks.
Yeah, so they had a... So he was a basketball player from Egypt that ended up in Armenia as well. Somebody told him that...
He was in Leningrad at the time.
But anyway, so that's how what got you on a basketball team.
Yes.
So and how did that become a way of making a living?
Because they paid me a stipend to play for the Institute of Physical Culture and Sports in Yerevan. And later on, as I entered the institute, they also gave me a stipend for attending school there. Fortunately, the coach liked me, and the head of the institute took a liking to me. I don't know if it was because...
So you were learning Armenian at this time, isn't
it? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And Russian.
Okay.
And Arabic. And
Why?
French.
Why?
Because my teammates were Arabic.
Oh.
We had an international team. We had repatriates from France.
I see. So
Egypt,
they became the team of Armenia, so to speak.
Which caused a problem, because the Deratsis, the natives, and the Nordkalos were like cats and dogs.
Right. Now, we got to explain that. You're talking Armenian. These people don't understand. The people that came to repatriate to Armenia, who came from different countries, and the people who were born and raised in Armenia... Had some friction among themselves.
Natural rivalry. To a point when we played for the championship of the Republic, a riot broke out after we beat them. And
who were you beating? Another Armenian team of people?
From Girovagan.
Oh.
From Girovagan, who had recruited. They had players from the Red Army. They had players from Georgia. Now, I don't know if the U.S. knows that. Well, yes, they should know by now.
So,
go on.
So their team wasn't pure people born and raised in Armenia.
No.
And you guys were known as an expatriate team.
Absolutely.
Okay, and you beat these people.
Yes.
So that caused a riot. So anyway, for how long is it now that you left in 1960, which is a story we'll take after the next break. So we're going to deal our time now as to your experiences there. So you played basketball from when to when? From the day from when you arrived, 6 months after you arrived, 6 days after you arrived. It must have been a while.
It was about from 1949 to 1960. I played my last game.
So there was 2 years there. You were
a year and a half.
You weren't playing basketball.
I was being followed by the KGB. After all, I was a sleeper, they thought.
Yeah. Did you ever go talk to him and say, why do you think I came here?
There was an interesting article written in 1995 about the team, and the article stated how I would disappear, and also how...
Where? Their press or ours?
In their press.
Okay.
The downfall of the Armenian basketball program. And I'm highlighted there, and so is Abraham, and so is a young man called... Armanak Alajijan, who played for the national team in the Olympics and finished second only to the U.S. The U.S. was the only team to beat the USSR. So, yes, I was able, because of basketball, to travel all over the Soviet Union.
Now we're at our next break. We're at there's about 11 minutes left of the program. And we have to accordingly try to get as much of your information in as possible. To our listeners, you must remember this is a pre-recorded program, which I haven't said before. You cannot call in. You are listening to Then and Now, a program devoted to how history affects current events. The history of Tom's experience hopefully will give us some insight into current events. And his book is entitled How a Red-Blooded American Boy at 19 Decides to Leave the United States and Go to Russia, which in this case the Armenian Republic in Russia. The book is entitled The Repatriate and Love, Basketball and the KGB. The Russians thought he was an American spy, and then when he comes back later on, the Americans think he's a Russian spy. We'll get into that in the next 11 minutes. The book is Moradian Publishing, www.tommoradian.com. The book is distributed by our own Wayne State University Press. And the price of the book is $24.95. You can get it online from Borders and Amazon.com. Barnes & Noble bookstores all around town. The book is released in November, and this is the month this program is being recorded, played. So, Tom, quickly tell us about your experiences there. And then, because now you got to quickly go into your experiences there and the mystery of how you were able to leave in 1960 and return
in
back.
In one sentence, right?
And not in one sentence, but return back to the good old U.S. of A.
Stalingrad. We played against Stalingrad. We beat the heck out of them. It's night. One of the officers who played gets two bottles of vodka and brings it to me and says, "American, you play good, don't you? We beat you." He says, "Drink with me." Of course. We sat down and drank, and we got drunk. He says, "You know, you Americans can bomb the hell out of us. You can level all our cities like you did to the Nazis did to Stalingrad. But you will have to come down here on our soil, and you will have to fight us on our soil. And you will never be able, you will never be able to do that." Does this ring a bell?
Why would Iraq, you
want to? Iraq. We can beat the hell out of Iraq. We can beat the hell out of Azerbaijan and Afghanistan and Pakistan, but we will never be able to convince them to live the life that we are living here. For centuries, they have lived their life. And as soon as our brave young men return to our country, they will return to the way they have lived for centuries. That's how you tie the two together.
So how did you, what happened? You don't know how it was that you, so you had a long basketball career from 1949 to 1960. Well, 11, 12, that puts you as, what, you went at 19, that was at 47, you're 21, you played for 11 years, you're 32, you're starting to be at
I'm old.
to play basketball yes. with young guys.
Yes, so I came back again. History repeats. No talents, but my former high school basketball coach.
No, I mean what I meant there is now you have to, how did you get out?
How did I get out? I'm hoping some old KGB officer will say,
Kalugin, that's the one that wrote the book about the Armenians and how they infiltrated Armenian organizations.
There are so
General Kalugin, maybe he can tell us.
There are so many unanswered questions in my mind.
So how did it happen? One day
I
you
don't
get
know.
It, I mean,
I was the first American Armenian to come home, and no one came after me. I was warned by the KGB that if I go back, and start becoming a tool, this is a direct quote, a tool of the capitalists, no one will follow me. And?
But I understand that. The question is, what happened? One day somebody knocks on your door, one day you get a letter with a ticket, or how did this invitation to leave come?
A KGB officer was watching a game that I was playing in, and after I got out of the game and was walking down...
Where was this game? In Armenia?
In Moscow.
In Moscow, okay.
In Moscow. I had taken a boat down the Moscow River, and somebody was following me, which was not uncommon. And I sat down in this boat, and the gentleman, stranger, came sat just like you are, right across from me. And that's not uncommon. Russians like...
I know.
Russians like to talk to foreigners.
Okay.
And he said, you are a very angry individual, and if all Americans are as angry as you are, we would be fighting them all the time. And then he said, we're going to send you home. I said, home, Yerevan. You don't need to send me home. He says, no, we're sending you back to America. I says, don't play with me. I'll throw you off of this ship.
This boat.
Whatever. And he said, I am serious. We are going to send you back to the United States. Okay. Khrushchev was going to meet with Eisenhower and the other big two for a big four conference in Paris.
So how did that manifest itself? 2 days later, somebody picks you up at a cab at your house?
Or? No, an idiot by the name of Gary Powers was shot down in Sverdlovsk,
yeah.
And it delayed my return to America.
Okay, but how did you end up? How did it actually end up? I'm curious. Somebody comes to your door, picks you up, and takes you to the airport? What?
No, I'm a Soviet citizen. I can travel. When he told me that you're going to go home, he gave me a list of things I have to do. I had to go back to Yerevan, go to the OVIR office, make an application, contact my parents, get the necessary information, and have OVIR apply.
And they knew you were coming, obviously.
Oh, obviously they knew I was coming. Not only that, so everything was going smoothly. Until Gary got shot down.
Okay, then how long after that did it take for them to send you?
Days. Yes.
So what happens? They put you on a plane to
where? They don't put me on a plane. I am now an American citizen. I put myself on the plane. I had my own finances. The U.S. Embassy told me, do we need to help you get back? I says, no. I have the money, the finances, the resources to go back home. And I got on a ship or on a plane and went to Copenhagen. Informed my parents that I was in Copenhagen, that I was coming back to New York, and I came back.
Okay, so somebody told the American embassy that you were leaving. Was that you or them?
Me.
You.
A couple of weeks before that, a guy by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald tossed his passport into the face of a guy by the name of Richard Snyder, who was my... I had an interview with him. And Snyder, allegedly, apparently, told Lee Harvey that there are people here who will beg to get back to the United States. You better reconsider what you're doing. And
Okay, so in the last remaining, we have something like a minute and a half. You want to say something about your return?
It wasn't what I thought it would be,
because
once I arrived in the U.S., I had no job. I had to live with my parents, and
how did you get from the airport to where?
My brother George picked me up from the airport, brought me to his home, and then they brought me home. But obviously, a person living in the Soviet Union for 13 years was a person of interest for the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited by the CIA to go to Washington to meet with them.
And did you go?
Oh, they flew me.
Okay. So when you had, where did you fly? Copenhagen to what? What was your
Copenhagen,
route?
New York.
To New York, and then New York
Detroit.
To Detroit? I see. Okay, we have about remaining 20 minutes. Let me take that time, 20 seconds, to thank you for being our guest today, and to remind our listeners to look on their at their friendly bookstore, the Wayne State University Press, for The Repatriate, to hear this interesting story, how a young American boy at 19 years old in 1947 immigrates to the Soviet Union. Basketball becomes his life and his savior, and for some unexplained reason is repatriated in the 1960.
Hi, I'm Mary Fall, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn, Michigan.
Meep, meep. Thinking about going back to college but don't have anyone to care for the kids?
You're absolutely correct.
The HFCC State Licensed Child Activity Care Centers offers child care for children of HFCC students, staff, and the public.
Isn't that lovely? Mm.
The Child Activity Care Center is dedicated to providing quality care for toilet-trained children from ages 2.5 to 12 years old.
Oh, goody!
Your child is in great supervision with a child-teacher ratio of 5 to 1, which also allows for attention to be given to individual needs.
Isn't that something?
The center is open Monday through Thursday, 6:45 a.m. to 10:15 p.m.